Greetings. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And we're building bridges. Will SCOTUS yield to white privilege and further eviscerate affirmative action in higher education or even strike the final blow? Meet Edward Blum, who wants SCOTUS to kill affirmative action in higher education, the case of SAFA versus Harvard. Events demonstrate that racial divides and racial discrimination persist in America. Efforts to promote affirmative action, as distinct from mere attestations to diversity or proclamations of colorblindness, cannot be viewed as a mere nicety. Attacks on affirmative action are not benign. There are real consequences for equal rights and justice at stake in SAFA versus Harvard, about to be heard by the Supreme Court. The real threat to Asian Americans is not affirmative action. It is Edward Blum's, its organizer and financier, brand of white privilege wrapped in the fallacy of colorblindness. We're joined now by Professor Ted Shaw, Professor of Law and the Director of the University of North Carolina Center for Civil Rights. Professor Shaw is a key architect and legal theorist of affirmative action in this country. He is what we would refer to in the profession of a lawyer's lawyer. Professor Shaw, I am suddenly in my mind's eye brought back to June 1978, along with thousands of protesters called together by, among other groups, the National Conference of Black Lawyers in front of the Supreme Court, where SCOTUS was poised and would rule upon the challenge to affirmative action from Alan Bakke, watering down affirmative action, not holding it per se unconstitutional, but that it was invalidating what it called racial quotas. Affirmative action is not about quotas. It's not about diversity. It's not about colored blindness. Talk about what affirmative action is rooted in as a corrective to historic and ongoing discrimination in higher education.
June of 78, that was the day that the Supreme Court handed down the Bakke decision. That was 10 years after the assassination of the great Martin Luther King Jr. That was a moment of inflection for the United States. Affirmative action existed already at that time for about 15 years. Because the terminology was first used in the early to mid-1960s during President Kennedy's administration and President Johnson's administration. At that time, there was a consciousness that the history of this country, the continuum between slavery to the Reconstruction era into the Jim Crow segregation era, took us up until 1954. It was only in 1954, of course, with the Brown decision that legally sanctioned racial subordination and discrimination and segregation began to crack. And that was the moment the Supreme Court began the process of moving America away from its form of apartheid. And in the 1960s, colleges and universities that had refused to admit and enroll African-American students and other students of color began to do that in a conscious way. And the justification, the imperative, was a remedial imperative, remedial in the sense that it was a remedy for that long continuum of racial subordination, beginning with slavery up through and into the 1960s. Many institutions of higher education that were selective began to admit significant numbers of African-American students after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. But almost immediately, a counterattack. And then a few years later, in 1978, the Supreme Court had Bakke before it. The first time it ruled on the issue of affirmative action in higher education, that was the case that threw affirmative action as we knew it under the bus. It was a very fractured opinion, 4-1-4, as there was one justice in the middle, Lewis Powell from Richmond, Virginia, a conservative justice, but he came up with the notion of diversity for the first time as a justification for affirmative action in the Bakke decision. It wasn't entirely clear. There were arguments about whether or not anyone in either of the other two camps, a more liberal camp and a more conservative camp, explicitly joined that justification, that diversity justification. But nonetheless, that became known as the Bakke opinion, which said, as a matter of First Amendment interest, universities could consciously consider race on a limited basis in admissions. I was there, Mimi, that day in the Supreme Court when Bakke was announced. I left the court devastated because for me and for African Americans, I thought Bakke was a law. I didn't know what this diversity justification would mean, but I knew it meant that the 14th Amendment-based interest of African Americans in having a remedy for that long continuum of segregation and discrimination as it impacted colleges and universities, that had been abandoned by the Supreme Court. And I did not know at the time, we did not know how much weight this diversity rationale would carry. It was clear that it was not the interest of black and brown students that carried the day, and instead it was the interest of universities and by extension of white students in having black and brown students in their institutions to round out education. We've been in a battle about preserving diversity ever since.
The 14th Amendment. What's the difference between vitiating the conception of affirmative action, the planning, the implementation of the process of affirmative action in higher education, rooting it in the 14th Amendment versus diversity, which has a pleasant and a satisfying ring, certainly to the white populace? And then taking it further into, aren't we a society that aspires to colored blindness? What's wrong with that within the context of the oppression historically, the slave system that the African American populace came from?
In the aftermath of the Civil War, the United States Congress and the people of the United States through the states promulgated and ratified three post-war amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. The 13th, of course, was absolutely necessary to put slavery in the rearview mirror. The 14th Amendment was necessary to begin the task of guaranteeing equality and equity for African Americans, for those coming out of slavery. But it also was necessary because the first thing out the box that the 14th Amendment said was that all persons born in the United States are citizens of the United States and the states in which they reside. That was necessary to overturn the Dred Scott decision, which said that, besides saying that Dred and Harriet Scott could not have their status as enslaved people changed by reason of being taken to territories in which slavery was not enforced. But also, the Chief Justice at the time, Roger Taney, carried a majority in saying that black people could not be citizens. No person of African descent could be citizens of the United States. Whether they were free or not, they could not be citizens of the United States. And I want to pause for a moment to say that there are a lot of people saying that the Supreme Court decision this past June in the Dobbs case, which overturned Roe versus Wade, was the first time in the United States history that a constitutional right had been taken away by the court. Not so. Think about Dred Scott taking away citizenship even for free African Americans in 1857. The 14th Amendment was absolutely necessary, and the citizenship clause is the first thing out the box. That's important these days in all these debates about immigration and conservatives saying that the children of people who are in the country without legality, those children, if they're born in the United States, should not be citizens. That's a straight violation of the first clause of the 14th Amendment. But the 14th Amendment also has the Equal Protection Clause in it, which is what's at issue in the Bakke case and was the basis for Brown versus Board of Education's decision that segregated schools violated the United States Constitution. There's the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment and other provisions that are important of the 14th Amendment. One most recently that was a provision, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which said that those who took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution and then betrayed that oath by engaging in insurrection could not hold office in the United States. So the United States was transformed by the 14th Amendment. And then, of course, the 15th Amendment guaranteed the right to vote against racial discrimination, although only for black males or for males, not for women. That, of course, didn't happen until 1920. So that's a quick run through the post-Civil War amendments, but it was the Equal Protection Clause that has carried over the years the weight of the battle against segregation and discrimination. So the Equal Protection Clause is the clause that black people, through representation, mostly by black lawyers in the early part of the 20th century, Charles Houston and Thurgood Marshall and all the great lawyers of the NAACP, Legal Defense and Educational Fund, began to invoke to bring segregation down. It was a long-term plan to bring down segregation that ended up in Brown versus Board of Education and in the years after Brown into the 1960s. Dismantling the legal apparatus of American apartheid. And it was the pushback by conservatives to that process that led to the anti-affirmative action cases that culminated in the Bakke decision, which said a lot of things that was problematic for African Americans, but it relegated African Americans in many ways to a marginalized basis in all of the litigation involving race and higher education after Bakke. And at that point that Bakke was decided, conservatives didn't lay down and accept it. They began to engage in a long game of overturning Bakke, just like they did after Roe versus Wade was decided. And that long game has resulted in diversity efforts in higher education, conscious efforts by colleges and universities under their First Amendment interest in deciding who attended their schools and what's taught and the quality of education being impacted by diversity. That's been challenged and it's gone to the Supreme Court multiple times, and the Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld diversity as a compelling governmental interests which justify consideration of race, but conservatives continue that attack, which has culminated in these two cases in the Supreme Court, one involving Harvard University, the first time that a private institution of higher education has been sued to prevent it from consciously trying to take race into account in admissions. And that's not through the 14th Amendment rights of white students, but it's through because the 14th Amendment doesn't apply to private institutions. It only applies to governmental institutions. But it's based in the First Amendment rights of the university. But the 14th Amendment is the cause of action in suing the public universities, like the University of North Carolina. The second case is up in the Supreme Court. Harvard is being sued under Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So it's statutory, not constitutional. But But the effect is pretty much the same. Title VI prohibits discrimination in federally funded programs, and Harvard, of course, like most, if not all, institutions of higher education, take federal funds. All of that may sound very complex, but the bottom line is that any and all efforts to attack our history of exclusion up for grabs right now.
I wonder if you can take us to your thoughts about the 25 years that you've been talking about and people like Edward Blum and the climate that have financed and sought to bring yet another case to SCOTUS to kill affirmative action in higher education. What's the politics behind that, Professor Shaw?
The politics that you're referring to are simply the politics of white supremacy, which never died. As we now know, given the events of the last years, particularly since the election of Barack Obama, which left many individuals unhinged about the changes in our country, they have been committed to not only turning around diversity efforts and keeping affirmative action in its grave, but they've also been very much committed to preserving white supremacy. Ed Blum would say that he is committed to colorblindness, which is an important part of the Constitution. Nowhere in the Constitution is the term colorblindness in place. It doesn't appear in the Constitution. In fact, the term was first coined in a dissent to the Plessy versus Ferguson decision that upheld separate but equal, and that was in place for 58 years until Brown versus Board of Education was decided. It's 1896 to 1954. But it was only in that dissent that the term colorblindness appeared. It has never been adopted by a majority of the Supreme Court, even though conservatives talk about it as if it is a constitutionally sanctioned principle. Here's the problem. The 14th Amendment was adopted by the 39th Congress. It was adopted by the same Congress that adopted a whole range of color-conscious programs and decisions to help African-Americans come out of slavery. The Freedmen's Bureau was explicitly race-conscious. Schools and hospitals for African-Americans explicitly race-conscious. Other programs to help African-Americans rise from slavery and its legacy. How could it be that the same Congress that adopted the 14th Amendment meant to say that it was explicitly a ban on all color-conscious activities? The 14th Amendment should ban invidious racial discrimination, that is, with evil intent to subordinate people because of their race, not attempts to try to uplift people who have historically been discriminated against. Ed Blum is a very wealthy individual who is, under the mantra of colorblindness, pursuing agendas that are intended to prevent any and all explicit programs and policies that are meant to include and empower African Americans in the aftermath of all of this history of discrimination. He would deny that, but that's what he was doing. He was behind the case that overturned a significant part of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, Shelby County versus Holder. He's the one who's repeatedly been behind cases that have been taken to the Supreme Court to try to make illegal diversity efforts in higher education in Texas and now in North Carolina and at Harvard University. And his program is one that is in sync with the agendas of white supremacy, even though he would heavily deny that that's what he's doing. So that's the sum of what he's doing and where we are on October 31st, Halloween. Ironically or not, these two cases involving the University of North Carolina and Harvard University are being argued in the Supreme Court. It is the racial analog of what happened in June with respect to Roe versus Wade. It's the opportunity for conservatives who have been in a long game ever since Bakke was decided to overturn that precedent.
Bloom's cynical, insidious, really, attempt to use members of the Asian American community to pit them against people of color, of the African American people. Such a direct antithesis of race-conscious admissions programs which endeavor to create a richly diverse college campus. Talk about what the legal premise is that is being presented to SCOTUS by this Bloom-concocted case that portends to do what was done to abortion, this time as perhaps the final death knell for affirmative action in higher education.
Having gone to the Supreme Court multiple times, unsuccessfully, in cases involving the legality and constitutionality of affirmative action in higher education, Ed Bloom and the lawyers whom he's financed have devised a cynically brilliant tactic in which they have put Asian American students, or attempted to put them front and center in this attack on diversity efforts. The argument, in essence, is that Asian Americans are being discriminated against by these diversity efforts focusing on bringing more black and brown students into higher education because color consciousness works against Asian Americans who score the highest. That's a very cynical argument, because admissions to these selective institutions is about much more than standardized tests. Yes, Asian Americans do score, for reasons that are complex and not even completely understood, highest standardized tests, higher than white students. But the arguments that are leading this attack on diversity are not that Asian Americans are being discriminated against in favor of white students, but rather the argument is that Asian Americans are being discriminated against in favor of black and brown students. By the way, there aren't enough black and brown students present in these selective institutions to account for all of the seats that they claim Asian Americans and Asians are being denied. But the thing I want to underscore is that Asian Americans are very much split about opposing diversity efforts. There are many friend of the court briefs, amicus briefs, that have been filed in the Harvard case in particular, that support diversity efforts and that recognize this history of discrimination against African Americans and black and brown people that need to be addressed. And yes, against Asian Americans also. And there are some Asian groups and Asian American groups that are opposed to those efforts. It's very complex, very split, but very cynical. And in fact, the Asian American Legal Defense Fund's amicus brief is right up front and very blunt about what's going on here, that it is white supremacists who are using Asian Americans as their Trojan horse in this battle against conscious efforts to include black and brown students in higher education after this long history of exclusion. So that's a short summary of what Ed Bloom is doing with respect to Asian and Asian American students.
And of course, the premise is a veil for white privilege to be preserved. What do you think needs to happen politically to rejuvenate, again, the phoenix of energy that the black liberation struggle and so much that flowed from that for indigenous people, for brown people, for women that grew out of and stood on the shoulders of the black liberation movement? Where do we go from here to thwart these efforts to wrest back what was won with blood, sweat, and tears, to level the playing field, not nearly for reparations that people of color have struggled for in this country. Ted Shaw?
That is the huge and central question. Where do we go with respect to this long struggle now that the extreme right and white supremacists, not sure that they're separable, they are engaged in this effort to ban all conscious efforts to address racial inequity and discrimination rooted in our long history. The Supreme Court has been hijacked by the far right, has been engineered to be the most conservative Supreme Court in the memories of about any person who's alive now. I don't think that we can rely on this Supreme Court to protect the rights of black and brown people. We've got to engage in a struggle that is political. That means everything at our disposal. All of my efforts and the efforts of most African Americans have been nonviolent in this country. We are at a point where there are some people who are threatening violence. I'm not talking about African Americans or black and brown people, but I'm talking about white supremacists. Black and brown people have the right to defend ourselves. But I think we have to engage foremost now in a political struggle. People have to fight to continue to preserve the right to vote or to win back some of the protections of the right to vote that have already been lost. There's another case we could talk about that is aimed at getting rid of the surviving part of the Voting Rights Act so that it would destroy the entire act. That case is in the Supreme Court.
Professor Shaw, we're going to have you back. You've been, as always, most informative. You are a lawyer's lawyer. You are one of the architects of affirmative action law. You are a champion of equal rights and justice. And I hope you'll come back, and then we'll take up the issue of voting rights, which you have enormous experience and involvement in. I can't thank you enough. I have been speaking with Professor Ted Shaw, Professor of Law and the Director of the University of North Carolina Center for Civil Rights, and so much more.
This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.